This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the education channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is Bruce Kuklick, the author of Fascism Comes to America, A Century of Obsession in Politics and Culture. The term fascist has been thrown around in American politics and culture for much of the 20th and 21st century. It is a popular epithet that is used to brand all kinds of political opponents from left to right. But what does the term mean? How is it used? How did it show up in American history and culture with the rise of fascist regimes in Europe before World War II? Why has its use persisted even as those regimes were defeated? And why has fascism come to carry such negative connotations? In Fascism Comes to America, Bruce Kuklick explores the history of the use and meaning of fascism in American politics and culture for the past 100 years. Bruce Kuklick is the Nichols Professor of American History Emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania. He is most recently the author of Death in the Congo, Murdering Patrice Lumumba, written with Emmanuel Girard, and The Fighting Sullivans. Bruce Kuklick, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Tom. I'm more than happy to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. Before we get into the substance of your book, I want to ask, what brought you to this project? That is to say, why a study of fascism? Why today?
Well, in one sense, that's really easy to answer. All you have to do is look at any one of the cable news channels any night, and you will find that someone or other in American politics has been being called a fascist. It's actually hard to escape the prevalence of the use of this term in the United States today. And I've always had, in addition to that, I've always had an interest in American diplomacy in the 1930s, the decade which led to World War II, and which is renowned, not least because of the rise of Mussolini and Hitler in Europe. So it sort of just emerged that I started thinking about how or why the present use of fascism is related to what went on in the 1930s. And the result was an increasing interest in the problems of this book. And I guess the other thing is, which I hope we'll get into, the entertainment industry has stoked for almost 100 years Americans' fascination with fascism. And I'm a great movie buff, and there are all these terrific movies which, in one way or another, speak about the issues of fascism for an American audience. And I would be it'd be honest for me to say that my interest in entertainment, and especially the Hollywood movie, provoked me into writing this book.
Okay. We will talk about some of those things. But before we get into that, I'd like to you to read from your book. If we could start with really just the opening paragraph to chapter one, right there on page one. If you could read that for our listeners.
Actually, I love this paragraph. I wrote it maybe and revised it 500 times. Google fascism comes to America, or search the topic on Amazon. Thousands of entries pop up. Reformers are fascists. Conservatives are fascists. Corporate business leaders are secret fascists. We find crypto, egalitarian, fastidious, modern, neo, and respectable fascists. Fascism can creep or be friendly or feel at home on Park Avenue. It can be sweet or mild or even watery. During the 1930s, U.S. followers of the Russian communist Joseph Stalin called the communist adherents of Leon Trotsky social fascists. During the same decade, some citizens dreaded that fascists might declare themselves as anti-fascists. More certainly, the government later chastised other citizens for their premature anti-fascism. During the 1970s, the Black Panthers of Oakland, California, identified liberals as fascist pigs. But another Oakland-based organization, the Symbionese Liberation Army, announced the assassination of a Black leader for his fascist plans for public school safety. Fascism has functional equivalents. Fascists often reemerge, while some politicians count as fascistoid or fascist-like. Roosevelt's New Deal had fascist affinities, and so did the Reagan Revolution. The Jim Crow South evidenced fascism, but so did its opponents in the civil rights movements. Barack Obama was a fascist, but so was John McCain. Donald Trump was undoubtedly a fascist, and on and on and on it goes. I mean, all you have to do is scratch the surface of this stuff, Tom, and you see that Americans are obsessed with this notion.
Yeah, it's kind of like an all-purpose political smear, isn't it?
Yes, well, that's the argument that ultimately I make, although I should say to interested readers, I don't necessarily push my own thesis. What I was trying to do in the book was to lay out all of the ways in which the phrase and its cognates were used, and then ask the reader, what do you think? And my own ideas, Bruce's ideas, are these. But think about it yourself, because it's an ongoing problem and issue, I think, in the United States.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about how we got here. So the first chapter describes the origins of fascism, including its prehistory in the United States. And beyond the actual coinage of the term in interwar Italy, where did fascists come from, and how did Americans respond to what was essentially a European idea?
Well, it's quite interesting. Mussolini takes power in Italy in the early 1920s. And at first, Americans see his rise to leadership basically as a positive phenomenon. And it's the people who were usually identified as American liberals, as progressives, who do this. Because after the after World War I and the retreat from Woodrow Wilson's internationalism, conservative Republicans come to power in the United States, and the liberals, when Mussolini takes over in Italy, think, gee, Mussolini is a lot like Teddy Roosevelt. That is, he's a nationalist. He believes somehow in a communal, more corporate form of government than Republican individualism in the United States allows. And so for these old time Teddy Roosevelt progressives, and also for Woodrow Wilson progressives, fascism as Mussolini exhibits it in the early 1920s is a positive development. And so throughout the 1920s, fascism makes its entrance into the United States as a positive development in Europe, which in effect is copying what somebody like Teddy Roosevelt did in the United States. At the same time, there's a little bit of withholding on the part of Americans, because they see that a kind of Mussolini's nastier aspects of Mussolini's rule were appropriate for a backward country like Italy, and they certainly aren't appropriate to the United States. So while fascism is positive, has a positive connotation, there's always a little bit of withholding on the part of American intellectuals who see it really as something that is more reasonable for a primitive country like Italy. What they want is for people like Mussolini to follow the more positive aspects of Teddy Roosevelt's set of ideas. Then, and this is when the big crunch comes during the Depression, when the world economy collapses in 29-30, and the problems of employment are the most serious issues for Americans for the next 10 years. And most people don't remember this or know this, but Adolf Hitler's regime came to power at the same time as Franklin Roosevelt's. And Hitler's regime is so mean-spirited and nasty, as we all know, especially its racial policies, that, as I put it in the book, Hitler taints Mussolini. They're both regarded as similar kinds of regimes, but all of the good qualities that people thought that Mussolini's fascism have are submerged when people see the Germans exhibiting what they came to see as the true outcome of Mussolini. So from the mid-1930s on, the connotation of fascism in the United States changes and becomes entirely negative. And then it becomes a very useful word, as you put it, to smear anybody that you don't like. And the best example of this, I think, is what happens to Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal. It immediately, by Roosevelt takes power in early 1933, and within a year, all of his political opponents are calling Roosevelt a fascist. Roosevelt doesn't take this sitting down, and immediately the Democratic administration and his followers call their opponents fascist. So right from the start, in American English, in American politics, fascism becomes a label which you can use to tar anyone whom you don't like.
So one of, and we've already mentioned this before, but one of the great pleasures of your book is the way you explore how the term fascism and kind of the ideas associated with it migrate across different cultural realms. So fascism is at once a political idea, a political ideology, and it's also one that manifests itself in popular culture. So tell us a little about what happens when the term moves between these different cultural areas.
Well, this is a topic which I really love to talk about. And I think it all starts with Groucho Marx, not Karl Marx, whom you might think of as a great critic of, or would have been a great critic of Hitler and Mussolini, but with Groucho. No. And in 1933,
when I hear Marx, I always go to Groucho first.
Yes. Well, in 1933, Groucho made the last of these terrific fun movies that he made in the beginning of the sound era of motion pictures. A film called Duck Soup. And Duck Soup is about a sort of lunatic leader of a small country called Fredonia, which has a historical background identical to the United States. And its leader is a guy named Rufus T. Firefly, played, of course, by Groucho Marx. And he decides to go to war against an opposing country because its leading diplomat has tried to muscle in on Groucho's girlfriend. So the country goes to war over this, over the issue of who has claim to this woman whom Groucho likes. The film was banned in Italy. It was released on the 10th anniversary of Mussolini's rule, that is in 32. That is, it's just at the time when fascism is being tainted by the rise of Hitler. And what one finds is that to the extent that ordinary Americans had an understanding of fascism, it derived not so much from the discussion, certainly not from the discussion of academics, and not even so much from the discussion of politicians, although that's certainly important. Rather, ordinary Americans got their understanding of these things from the world of entertainment. And it's just amazing to see the response of the folks in Hollywood to national political issues. There are a lot of serious movies, serious anti-fascist films that are made, but the ones that strike me as most interesting and the ones that penetrate most deeply into popular culture is this genre which Groucho Marx begins, which I call the farce of fascism. And it is the most fascinating aspect of the use of fascism and its cognates that I found. Because here you have the most horrible, Hitler's regime is the most horrible regime in the history of the planet. Yet somehow, and for some reason, the entertainment industry, and particularly Hollywood, finds a way to make a joke out of it. And so you have Groucho Marx's Duck Soup followed, for example, by Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, followed by Dr. Strangelove in the early 1960s, followed by one of my favorite films of all time, the Zero Mostel film, The Producers. Here you have, this gets us maybe a little ahead of where you want to be, but I love this story. The Producers is a movie about a Broadway play that the two producers of it have brought to a Broadway designed to in a way that's designed to fail. And there's a kind of sort of complicated story of why they want to produce a show on Broadway that's going to flame out. But the show they do is called Springtime for Hitler. Now, you have to think, and this is 1967, in the middle of the Vietnam War, the high period of protests, where the president of the United States at the time, Lyndon Johnson, and the people around him are calling all of the demonstrators against the war in Vietnam student fascists. And the kids who are protesting are calling the political leaders fascists. A very, very precarious time in the history of the Republic, where you have these labels traded back and forth with an angry denunciation, marches on the Pentagon, all sorts of disruption to normal activities. Very serious time. And yet, here the producers becomes a smash movie hit. And what it does is show the way in which the two Broadway producers put on a Broadway play called Springtime for Hitler, in which the lead song goes Springtime for Hitler in Germany, Winter for Poland and France, Deutschland needs a great leader. And if you watch the movie, you can see a huge banner of Adolf Hitler come down in the middle of your screen, and cannons shooting off into the audience, these artillery shells. I mean, it's amazing. And what the farce of fascism means and how it reflects what's going on in American culture is a conundrum that I don't completely understand. But the phenomenon requires some description and some looking over if you're at all interested in American cultural history.
Yeah, it's the film, as you said, is absolutely fascinating. And even the remake that appeared a couple of decades later. So I want to talk, though, a minute, as a myself, a scholar of communication and rhetoric. Your third chapter is especially interesting. And so I want you to talk a little bit about what is meant by the phrase, the map is not the territory. And what does that axiom have to do with the study of fascism?
Wait, let me see. You're asking me a hard question here. you were asking about all of the
Korzybski and
the
general semantics movement.
Yeah, this is a very interesting issue, actually. In the 1930s. A whole movement grew up, which was connected to the rise of what was called logical positivism in Germany and then in England. And this is a philosophical movement which was centered around the uses of language, and the argument was that we had two very distinct uses of language. One was fact-stating scientific language. The other was a different sort of use of language, which was, in their terms, usually called emotivism. The use of language not to describe something or state a fact or to make a scientific theory, but rather to arouse people's emotions, to get them to do something, so that you had evaluative language as opposed to descriptive. I am still very partial to this theory, but one of the things that happened when these views got translated into the United States, they became the possession not just of scholars and philosophy departments in the United States, but to a whole crew of people called semanticists, some of whom were big supporters of Franklin Roosevelt and the Democratic administration. And what they did was quite interesting, because what they said, they took all of their political opponents, that is the Republican conservatives who were opposed to Franklin Roosevelt, and said, hey, you guys are misusing language. When you say Roosevelt is a fascist, what you're doing is emoting. What you're trying to do is persuade people of certain things that aren't true. Your language fails. Your language is unfortunate and inaccurate. You're making a fund. They basically reduced the Republican politics to making what they thought was an elementary philosophical error to confuse fact-stating language with emotional language. It's interesting that you find that a fascinating movement. I did also, but I also think that it was a way of labeling and castigating your opponents, which probably didn't have much bite with the general population. Although there is, if you've since you've read this carefully, Tom. There's one very interesting book in which the author does a sampling of people in the United States. Actually, he did it up in Connecticut, where he lived, and he found that asking people what fascist meant, that he found like 20 different varieties of definition, none of which, some of which didn't overlap, some of which were completely opposed to one another, but which he thought corroborated his ideas that the Republicans were misusing the term. Then, of course, all of these guys said they could properly use the term. And if you were a good Democrat semanticist, you found that all the Republicans were really fascist, that you could find a cognitive core to what fascism meant. And with that, you were able to describe scientifically your opponents of fascism. So here I find another example of people I don't want to say being confused, but certainly unable to prevent themselves from the allure of using this term to castigate your opponents. It became the way, by then it was the way that you had of making the worst of anybody you opposed, Tom.
So let's talk a little bit about that worst of anyone you oppose. So I'm talking to you not far from Royal Oak, Michigan, and the Shrine of the Little Flower Parish.
Oh, really?
And in the in the fifth chapter, we start to get up into the U.S. entry into World War II. And my students are frequently surprised to find that this was as fraught a decision as it, you know, in retrospect, shouldn't have been, right? So tell us a little bit about the America Firsters. And of course, I'm especially interested to learn about Father Charles Coughlin.
Yeah. Gee, this is interesting. And you might not agree with me about this, but I am much more sympathetic to the what was called at the time the American First Movement than most people are today. That is to say, there were genuine political issues surrounding the decision by the United States under Franklin Roosevelt to go to war against the Germans, which he and the Japanese, which he finally did in 1941. In the lead up to the decision of the Roosevelt administration, there was a lot of concern about the justifiability of the United States entering the war in entering European problems again. And this is a fraught set of issues. We had entered World War I in 1917, 1918 to straighten out European troubles. 20 years later, Europe, less than 20 years later, Europe was back in the soup with the British and French on the one hand, against the Italians and the Germans, with the Russian communists in the Far East complicating matters by switching from one side to the other. During this period, the Roosevelt administration is absolutely determined, I think, to get the United States on the side of the British and French. Roosevelt, and I entirely agree with you about this, ultimately thought that Hitler and Hitlerism was just an existential threat to the United States and beyond that, to general decency in the world. He was opposed, however, during this period by the group generally, it was a wider movement than this, but the most famous part of the movement were those people called American Firsters. And they had arguments on their side, because then it wasn't clear at that time, for example, just how horrible Hitler's policies towards Jews, towards gypsies, towards gays would be. And the American Firsters thought the Germans might be horrible, but it would be equally horrible for the United States to try to get into this war again, because we had seen in World War I that we hadn't succeeded in changing European politics. Why would it be any better in World War II? So there was a very, very heated set of controversies surrounding American overseas commitments during this period. One of the more interesting controversialists during this period was your friend in Royal Oak, Michigan, Father Charles Coughlin, a Roman Catholic who was known as the radio priest, who did actually support Roosevelt initially, but then became a very, very vicious critic of him. And someone who became, I think, sort of unfairly identified with a pro-Hitler stance. But what is interesting, I think, about Coughlin and about Roman Catholics at this time, before and after Coughlin's time, is this. Roman Catholics, until very recently, have been they haven't been considered proper Americans or true Americans. The United States is still a deeply Protestant culture. Joe Biden is only the second American president who was a Roman Catholic. His predecessor, Jack Kennedy, had a heck of a time in the 1960s convincing people that if he were elected, people were convinced that if he were elected, the Pope would come up the Potomac River in a grand yacht and take over the United States. This is back in the 1930s when the shady nature of Roman Catholics was really on a lot of people's minds. And here's what's most interesting to me about Roman Catholics and the notion of fascism. What Catholics thought about the United States was that it was far too much an individualistic culture, that you needed to care for the poor and the sick. You needed a more corporate sort of government, a government which would look to the communal health of the general public and not be concerned so much with individuals. That is, to some extent, the Catholics were more social democrats than the Protestants. And a lot of them, and Coughlin is the best example, were sympathetic not so much to Hitler, but to Mussolini and to Mussolini's corporate sense of an Italian community that had to that had to operate with the concerns of the poorest and less well off in mind. So what happens with Coughlin is that you find him speaking out in favor of Mussolini and in favor of some sort of communal sense of well-being. And he did this on his famous radio show, which reached millions of Catholics and some non-Catholics. The result is, by the late 30s, what happens? The powers that be, the certainly the Roosevelt people, don't like him. And what happens? He's called a fascist. And he's linked at that, and since fascism at this time in Europe is linked to Hitler, he's so soon identified as a Hitlerite. So I'm more sympathetic to Coughlin and to American First people than most scholars are. But at the same time, the overriding thing is not, at least from my point of view, is not that, but that again, the role of the concept of fascism comes in to stigmatize these people. Again, it shows itself as this powerful way of condemning an opponent.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and that situation didn't really change. That is, that idea that, you know, Roosevelt could be a fascist and Charles Coughlin could be a fascist, even though they're on opposite sides of the spectrum, until America's entry into war, and then World War II kind of stabilizes the meaning of fascism for a while. I mean, I guess this seems obvious, but why don't we talk a little bit about how fascism sort of held still for the war years.
Yeah. Well, what is interesting to me in this phase of the linguistic career of fascism is that there are two phases to it. First, fascism, because the United States, when it gets into the war, allies itself at least opportunistically with Stalin's Soviet Union, that the fascists become defined as the real evil that both the United States and the Soviet Union are fighting. So you have at once as you put it, a stabilization of this negative aura that fascism has. And then as soon as the United States wins the World War II, the Cold War emerges as this further, in geopolitics, fight for primacy in world statesmanship between the Soviet Union and the United States. And so that fascism, in a way, declines in importance because there is now another enemy, the communists. But one of the things, the first thing that happens, and you can predict this almost, is that while the live fascists, the ones who defined World War II, Hitler and Mussolini, are gone, for the Americans, you have another really terrible enemy, the Soviet Union. And so what do you do? How would you describe an enemy to make that enemy the worst kind of group in the world? You pull out fascism, and soon the label fascism is used to designate the people in the Soviet Union. They're really a different kind of brand of fascism. So while the real fascists go out of power, there's a new group which was at one point defined in opposition to fascism, now becomes fascist. And so we see another linguistic turn, Tom, in this use of the word, where it becomes the opposite of what it was. That is, it was once used to describe the great enemies of the Soviet Union, and now the Soviet Union itself gets defined as that kind of entity. I just find, and this is another episode in this evolution of the use of the term, in which it becomes the most negative signifier Americans are capable of dreaming up, Tom.
Although we try some other things, right? So in the second section of the book, specifically in chapter 7, you talk about people trying to make some distinctions. And so I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the difference between fascism and what came to be regarded as totalitarianism.
Yeah, well, this is actually what is for me the least the least significant of the debates about fascism, because it's a debate which is largely within the walls of the academic world. And one of the arguments that I make in the book, which is actually peripheral to what we've been talking about, but which I think is nonetheless interesting, is that ever since the time of Mussolini in the early 1920s, academics have been talking about these things, arguing what is really the central cognitive content of fascism, what the definition is, how you analyze it, how you verify it. And I would say these debates among academics reach their high point in the aftermath of World War II, and actually into the post the immediate post-war period, that is in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, you have all sorts of academics trying to define various brands of fascism, various subcategories of it. And the most important set of definitions involves around this term totalitarianism, which basically tries to argue or does argue that you have one set of governmental regimes, which can be called, well, I guess, which be called democratic. Their alternative is the totalitarian regime. And the totalitarian regime is one in which, as you can guess from the word itself, there is an attempt for the state to be the total, the sum of all loyalties and commitments, leaving no room for the individual, leaving no room for personal freedoms. Everything is absorbed by the state. And when you do this, then you can make some sense out of the fact that even though the United States was allied to Russia in World War II, both Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin all fall under this the rubric of totalitarianism as opposed to democracy. And during the Cold War, this is a very useful tool for American politicians, because what they can do in sorting out who their enemies are in this huge geopolitical struggle, what the Americans can do is figure out where to put certain regimes. That is, if they really don't like them, if they find they're a threat, they become part of the totalitarian group. And the chief one among this is obviously the Soviet Union, but it also comes to encompass the Chinese communists, comes to encompass the North Koreans, for example. And then you then try to discriminate between people whom you think are the real baddies, the totalitarians, as opposed to those who might be only autocratic or demagogic, but whom you can still work with. So while the notion of fascism, as I put it, declines in significance during this period, it has a surrogate that is totalitarianism, which is very useful for Americans in fighting the Cold War, Tom.
And a lot of this discussion about all of these various distinctions are influenced by initially by European refugees, thinkers who influenced the American discussion of fascism. And there are a variety of different strands from different national origins discussed in your eighth chapter. But is there a general pattern that emerges from all of these different influences in the U.S.?
Yes, and this actually you're talking about chapter 8, which is Europeans bring fascism to the United States, which is actually one of the first chapters I wrote because I found it so interesting. As I pointed out earlier, the guys who were called logical positivists in Europe were a very important philosophical group, intellectual group, who actually then a lot of whom migrated to the United States during the rise of Hitler. And they were just one of many groups of European intellectuals who came here during the 1930s and who really enriched American intellectual life in an amazing set of ways. A lot of people who claim to be patriots are very proud of the American way and American ideas and things like that. They would be well advised to look at what happened in the 1930s when the notion of what was American was vastly enhanced by all these Europeans. Having said that, in their defense, what I think is what was interesting to me in writing this book is that when all these people came to the United States, they immediately presume that they were dealing in part with another fascist country. That is, they had left mainly Germany, although not exclusively. They came to the United States, which opened its arms to them and gave them employment and prestige. And all they could do over and over and over again was to write and think and believe that the United States was really a peculiar kind of fascist country. That is, they used their own ideas of what fascism was like, mainly in Germany, and saw the same phenomenon in the United States. And here again, you see whether they were Germans or whether they were refugees from Europe or native-born Americans, fascism again emerges for these European intellectuals as the worst sort of political system one can imagine. And here these Europeans found it in America. And my best example of that is actually Hannah Arendt, whom I don't like very much, to tell you the truth. And the reason I don't is that in one of her important books, she wrote this basically history of political thought in the United States, in which she said the founding fathers were the greatest exemplars of good thinkers who talked about good governance in a country. They are, as you know, Franklin, Jefferson, Hamilton, Madison, are all the founders from the late 18th, early 19th century. But then, according to Hannah Arendt in her History of American Politics, things went completely downhill. And she said there was no real thinking in the United States for over over 150 years from, let's say, 1800 to 1950. And when people finally do start thinking in a strategic way about politics again, according to Hannah Arendt, they're all fascists. So that there's a Jeremiad about fascism for Hannah Arendt, so that when she comes to the United States in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, she's facing a fascist America, which she lambastes every chance she gets. When she is being wined and dined in New York by all sorts of intellectuals and has the American world at her feet, all she can do is condemn the United States for having its peculiar form of fascism, Tom.
Yeah. So there are a lot of different strands to pick up in this book. And again, I hope that, one of the reasons we do this is to encourage listeners to go out and find the book and read it for themselves and make their own decisions about the issues that you're raising. As we come to an end, I want to kind of merge the final two chapters together and ask a little bit about the relationship between democracy and fascism and whether we can have fascism without fascism.
Well,
I know that's a lot, but
no, yeah. How can I do that in 30 seconds?
You got more time than that. But
okay. The last chapter, what I do is take democracy, as an equally polarized political word, which has a positive connotation as fascism has a negative one. And what I try to do is to examine what fascism originally meant in America or in the early republic. It was not then a positive term. It was not then a concept that the founding fathers found fruitful. In fact, it was negative in implication. That is, the founding fathers did not like democracy. It favored short-term solutions that were based in passion instead of reason. It led to demagoguery and giving the voice to people who should not have a voice. And if you look at their debates, what they called what they were doing was creating a republic, that is, a government which was popular, as they called it, but which was much, much more concerned to limit the voice of the people. You had to give the people a voice, but you had to constrain it in various ways, or else it would go in the direction of democracy, which they considered to be perhaps not an evil, but certainly something to be feared. And the argument I try to make in the last chapter is that if we compare the way in which democracy's career, the career of that concept, has become gone from negative to positive, just as the career of fascism has gone from positive to deeply negative. And I close by using this phrase, fascism without fascism, as a kind of ironical way of talking about, guess who, Donald Trump. I think Trump is a Democrat, a small d Democrat, in the sense of what the founders made of it. That is, this is a guy who relies on the voices of all sorts of people whom the founders thought should have no voice. But that to call him a fascist is to make a serious kind of error, because if fascism, you know, here, think of what Hitler's fascism meant. It meant something that was deeply anti-Semitic. Here you have a guy whose son-in-law is whose beloved son-in-law, by the way, is a Jew. And he has, and his wife is converted to Judaism, and he had, and so Trump has a Jewish daughter and Jewish grandchildren. How can you call someone like that a fascist? In addition, if you think of Hitler's Germany, here was a culture which had the enormous popular support. You know, 90% of the people approved of Hitler. With Trump, it's maximum of 45%. The whole, you know, the culture is not the sort of one that that Hitler would have recognized at all. And I go on and on like that in that vein to suggest the ironies involved in our use of political language. And I ask, and this is, I'm glad you brought this up. I mean, if you have people who will read the book because of the podcast, and I hope you do, I don't want to force my views on them. What I want them to do is think about these political issues in a critical way and try to get away from cliches in thinking about them, and rather kind of, you know, have a kind of empirical sense of trying to figure out what these political terms actually mean and what they lead us to do, Tom.
Well, again, that is what we're here for. Hopefully someone goes out and is inspired to take a look at the book. Bruce Kuklick, thank you once again. I usually close by asking, although I noted at the beginning that you're a professor emeritus, so what can we expect next?
Oh, gee, I'm glad you asked that question.
What are you working on?
I can sell some books. I wrote a single author, short, brief, but actually very interpretive textbook called A Political History of the USA, One Nation Under God. It's in a second edition where I am, as we speak, I am working on a third edition, which will really bring the history up to date over the last 20 years. And it is scheduled to come out in January of 2025, right after the 2024 election. And I tell people to make a note or, you know, put it on their list, because I really enjoy working on this. It's highly interpretive, but it's very seriously researched. I've got a lot of people helping me out with ideas and suggestions. But that's what's next on my agenda.
Terrific. Bruce Kuklick, thank you once again for your time and for your work on this topic.
Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
So once again, my guest today has been Bruce Kuklick, the author of Fascism Comes to America, A Century of Obsession in Politics and Culture, out from the University of Chicago Press. My name is Tom DeSena, and you are listening to the New Books Network.